From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, two stories about getting in too deep with nature and seemingly no way out. Our first story comes to us from Outside In producer Jimmy Gutierrez.
Hey, Sam.
Who's here with some storm chaser videos. All right, Jimmy, what are we looking at here?
So this is a video that I found online, and this is my dude, Justin J-Time Drake. Justin getting out into the winds of Hurricane Irma as the eyewall slams into the Keys. This is one video I saw, and I wondered, how did he survive?
All right, let's see.
Oh, my God.
Oh, right right there. God. How does he not die?
Oh, so he's got like a paintball mask on. He's holding up something in the air. Oh, and the paintball mask just flew off his head. And oh.
Like this wind is standing him straight up. He's got a deep lunge.
Deep lunge.
He was on all fours a moment ago.
Oh.
So that's Justin Drake.
That's bonkers. How fast was that wind?
So he says he clocked it at 117, but as you saw, he's getting blown around by the wind. He said his best guess was that it was at least 130 miles per hour. But he just gets pushed so far back. I thought that was the moment my heart sank, and I was like, he's dead. I'm watching a suicide video.
Suicide by hurricane.
Suicide by hurricane. But he wasn't, and he didn't die.
He did not die.
Thankfully. And so I gave him a call, and I asked him about that video.
I have plenty of friends. I will fully admit, I had friends that were like, Justin, we'll be praying for you. Why are you doing that? That's crazy, blah, blah, this and that. I have no problem going out there and playing in the wind. It's like kind of man versus nature for me. It just is, and I love seeing how strong the winds are and if I can stand in it.
And like, what do people say about this video?
Let's just say opinions vary.
I mean, I've seen some people that were like making jokes about, man, he must not skip leg day, or man, he's crazy, or you have the negative comments where they're like, man, he's going to win the Darwinism Award, or why would somebody do that? He's an idiot, this and that.
Well, I mean, is he an idiot? Like, what's your sense of this?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack with that question, and so So how about we spend an episode on it?
Yes or no answers, Jimmy. Yes or no.
No!
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today, storm chasing. It's a hobby we love to hate in the comments section, but if you look at the TV ratings or the YouTube views, it's clear that we can't look away either. So rather than taking pot shots, we wanted to understand storm chasers, what motivates them to actively put themselves in front of a storm when everyone else is taking shelter. And ultimately, do we owe them an apology?
So we're going to get back to Justin in a minute here. But to kick things off, I want to introduce you to a couple of chasers who dabble in tornadoes. Here's Jennifer Brindley-Ubel.
They're kind of like amoebas to me. They're these big, watery things, and they're alive. And you kind of watch them bulbously saunter, you know, across the landscape.
Jennifer is from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She's a portrait photographer who came to chasing, like a lot of folks did, around the same time.
I first had an interest in storms because of the movie Twister. I'm actually part of what's referred to lovingly as the Twister generation of storm chasers.
Well, everybody likes the movie Twister. I mean, it's kind of like a cult thing. I don't know. I may have watched it 700 times or so.
This is Randy Hicks.
I got my first copy at McDonald's, I think. They had an offer where you buy a Happy Meal and you can get the movie Twister for $5.
Randy founded the Outlaw Chasers, which is a small chasing gang based out of Missouri. When I asked him to find a quiet place for us to talk, he took a seat in an 87 Toyota pickup he was junking for spare parts.
I've got a ninth grade education. I'm pretty much a simpleton. I'm a little dyslexic. But I understand storm structure, tornadoes, how they move, how they think, where they're going, just from seeing 400 or 500 of them through the last 25 years.
All of these chasers want you to know something. They are not irresponsible thrill seekers.
I tell people all the time, like, listen, I'm a professional. Like, I've been storm chasing now for well over a decade. I got my degree in meteorology, so I can make forecasts, and I know what to expect.
Justin says those measurements from Irma, he sent them off to the National Weather Service for record. And as far as the video goes, there was a lot of planning that went on behind the scenes. For example, he made sure he was upwind and aware of all hazards. He also scouted his position a day and a half before, looking for the highest point on the bridge.
That's always the big thing. Find the high point. So if the storm surge does get that high, you can survive through it.
Storm surge is one big reason why most chasers avoid hurricanes. But maybe even more so, they're not as photogenic. They're sloppy, like blurred visions of wind and rain, unlike tornadoes. Tornadoes may also be preferred because they're more accessible for chasers interested in science.
We're working with some photogrammetry and some other things. I can't talk too much about the project because it's still somewhat under wraps at the moment.
What we do is rather extreme, trying to put probes in tornadoes, so we have to go within a close proximity, which, well, I mean, you saw the video, so you know what we're doing.
Yes, yeah, I did. What he's doing is exactly like the plot of Twister, using probes to get readings from inside of tornadoes. Randy says he's the first person to get a probe with video inside a tornado 6 days before legendary chaser Tim Samaras did it. That's a name you're going to want to remember. But if you're going to drop a probe inside of a tornado, you got to get real close.
We're in the tornado!
Oh, sorry.
I know it.
This is a video of Randy and another outlaw chaser named Lisa. It's 2006, and they're in Nebraska on a dirt road surrounded by cornfields and mud.
Oh, yeah, who's your daddy?
Oh, my God.
Oh, hang on, here comes another one. Oh, watch out.
Oh, my God.
Hold on, Lisa.
It's absolutely downpouring. I don't know if you heard that, but the storm just blew their pickup's back window out.
I don't know what window we lost.
And we lost the whole, we lost the camper back and our back.
All right.
They're in the middle of an active tornado.
Look at that piece of debris! Woo!
This video looks as dangerous as it sounds, and it's exactly the thing that people point to when labeling chasers as adrenaline junkies, or candidates for the Darwin Award. Chasers like Randy will say their science requires them to get closer than other researchers are willing to. They would also tell you that extreme weather is newsworthy. If this is your town, Nebraska, you want to know if there's a tornado in it. And if you turn on the local news, you're going to want to see it.
I'm Corey Hartman, owner and operator of Severe Studios and SevereStudios.com, and we've been streaming live tornado video for over 12 years.
Corey's what's called a video broker. Think of Randy's video or Justin's Irma video. They send it to someone like Corey who helps get them paid.
Basically, how that works is they shoot a video, they send it to me, I pitch it to the networks and the local TV stations, see if somebody wants it. If they do, they pay. And I take a percentage of that as my cut for doing the work, and the rest gets passed off to them.
Back when the Twister generation was coming into their own, there was still good money in selling storm videos. Since then, though, things have changed. But if you're sitting on a gem like what you just heard, there's always a market.
Well, let's take the Who's Your Daddy tornado is what they call it on CNN, because after it went over my truck accidentally and blew all my back glass out, I screamed Who's Your Daddy at it and shook my finger at it. But of course, I get on CNN and don't try this at home. There's trained professionals in Oklahoma. This guy's a hillbilly retard. After they paid me $1,900 for it, then they disrespected me.
Randy said he made about $6,000 in total off the video. A big haul, especially considering how the chasing community has been growing.
We used to be able to get to, you know, $2,000, $1,500 the next day for a great tornado video to one network. And it's not really close to that anymore. And a lot of that is because of the Twitter and Facebook and YouTube videos from, a 12-year-old with an iPhone.
And with the proliferation of HD cameras and real-time radar, it's never been easier to capture a storm and more difficult to make a buck. But if there are any truths in this world, it's that great video and compelling characters always sell.
They are the hunters. This is their prey.
In 2007, Randy and his friend Lanny Dean were contacted by True TV for what he says was to be a 3-year reality TV show called Tornado Hunters.
They came out and spent like 2-3 days with us, and they did a bunch of interviews and, you know, reenactments. And then they packed up their little bags. They went back to their studios.
Their methods get them branded as outlaws by other chasers.
The final product was a one-hour show, not a three-year deal. Randy thought he was going to be financially set for years. In the end, he was used for another quick TV hit.
Outlaw chasers, we're the best!
When you're a nobody and someone gasses you up telling you you're amazing and you do great things and we're gonna make you a star and you're never going to have to worry about being hungry or sleeping in cars again, you buy into that pretty quick.
Yeah. Even if you do land a deal with a big network, there's no promise you'll be set. Justin Drake was featured on a couple shows. First, Tornado Road in 2009, and then a show called Storm Riders, which ran for four seasons.
And what's been interesting, for me at least, is that they have been showing like reruns of our show a lot. Not only of just Storm Riders, but Tornado Road itself.
When we had talked, I think it was like the day before or coming up that week, they had filled from like midnight to like 5 a.m. with nothing but Storm Riders. Do those royalties like flow downstream to you?
No.
Justin and his chase partner and co-star Simon get no payment in perpetuity for their show. Justin says it's impossible for chasers to negotiate because there's 100 other chasers that would jump at the chance. Networks exploit this, and they've proven they have no problem talking down to the people whose video they buy and air. All of this can make for a rocky relationship with the media.
That's why when you first communicated with me, I thought, well, this guy's just another piece of radio guy that wants to talk about everything that's wrong with chasing so they can about it for a week and try to shut it down like all these other reporters do.
When networks do hire people like Justin and Randy, they usually do so as independent contractors. What this means is besides giving up the long-term rights of your likeness and image, it also gets networks out of providing basic benefits like insurance, which could be very useful if you're chasing tornadoes. What we've been dancing around here is that tornadoes and extreme weather can kill. They destroy communities, homes, crops, displace families. There is a wake of destruction that follows. Part of the thrill is that chasers are literally skirting disaster. That is, until they get too close. Before Corey Hartman was a video broker, he was a storm chaser.
You know, I got hit by a tornado myself back in 2008, and I had a newborn child at home, and I had to call my wife and say, don't turn on the TV because my video is going to be plastered all over the place.
In the video he warned his wife about, it's around dusk in mid-June. Corey's out with his chasing partner, Kenny Allen, and they're live streaming video of this storm for a local station out of Omaha, Nebraska.
One bar, here we go, calling Omaha right now.
This is an absolutely horrible place to chase, as you can tell by the terrain,
yeah, exactly,
and the hills and the dirt road and the trees. So we pull out on top of this overpass and there it is.
There's gotta be a rain wrapped tornado in there. You gotta get on the air. Yeah, that'd be great. There's gotta be a tornado in there, man.
When a tornado isn't moving right to left or left to right, guess which direction it's coming? Straight toward you.
You can hear Corey say, I can't get out of it. The storm's moving 50 plus miles per hour and they can't get over 35 on this dirt road.
The rain just starts coming down harder and harder and harder and harder to the point where I can barely see the road.
We're right underneath it, dude. It's swirling right above us. Oh, God.
And then you should probably turn the audio up at this point and just watch from this point forward.
We're in the tornado.
We're in the tornado.
Our ears are popping.
My ears are popping.
Our ears are popping. The tornado is right over us right now.
Holy smokes.
You guys were live?
Yeah, we were live.
Corey Hartman and Kenny Allen almost live streamed their deaths to the Omaha market. The thing is, this wasn't Corey's first chase. He thought he knew what he was doing. The fact is, storm chasing is risky no matter who you are. It took something this dramatic for Corey to pull back from chasing. And with the money he made from this video, he turned his hobby website, Severe Studios, into a business. Ironically, it was his most dangerous video that gave him the opportunity to get out of the game. I'm looking at this and you seem like a pretty safe guy. And like, you know, I thought
so at the time.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There are these instances where you can't remove yourself from the danger because you are chasing a tornado.
You know, that's really what happened to Samaras. You know, you can, you, I mean, I'm sure everybody has said, you know, we thought Tim was the safest chaser out there. But yet he would put himself very, very close and just hope that he could get back out of the way.
If you've heard of one storm chaser, it's probably Tim Samaras. He's the most respected, highest profile, and according to many, the safest chaser out there. Which brings us to the storm that forever changed the chasing community, the El Reno, Oklahoma tornado.
Hi, Tim. What are you seeing on the ground there in Oklahoma?
Right now, the skies are fairly clear. We do not have storm initiation, but we fully expect storm initiation probably within the next 2 to 3 hours.
This is Tim Samaras, and he knew what a lot of chasers knew on May 31st, 2013. That central Oklahoma was about to get rocked.
And boy, the ingredients are coming together for a pretty volatile day.
Tim's famous for his work studying tornadoes and lightning. He's also completely self-taught. When I talk to chasers like Jennifer Brindley-Ubel, they used words like genius and pioneer.
I mean, if I'm listing off my chasing heroes, Tim Samaras is at the top of the list.
As a kid, Tim would take apart and rebuild radios and TV sets. Eventually, he started building his own probes to drop into the paths of tornadoes. With a storm like El Reno, there was too much good science for Tim to pass up.
Tornado Alley is famous for these types of weather systems coming through. It only happens maybe two, maybe once, twice, or three times in an entire year. We get days like this where the systems and the ingredients come together so just right to generate these incredible, powerful storms. And today is no exception.
If you're talking about slang, we might refer to a day with large tornadoes as a career day. It might be a day where you could get some of the best footage in your career.
Jennifer, Justin Drake, and 100 other chasers converged on El Reno, looking to get in on the action. A little after noon, local meteorologists were calling for thunderstorms with large hail just west of the Oklahoma City metro area. But as the day went on, the storms held off.
When me and Simon were sitting in this parking lot, 3 o'clock hit. Storm still unfired.
The longer the storms held off, the more unstable the atmosphere grew, and the more potential energy stored up.
4 o'clock hit. Storm still hadn't fired, and we're like, oh man, today's going to be big.
All right, storms continuing to develop just west of Oklahoma City. Not really called storms yet. Better to be safe than sorry. This thing looks like it's going to turn into one humongous cyclonic supercell.
Around 5 o'clock, right, Tim Samaras tweeted, storms now initiating south of Watonga along Triple Point. Dangerous day ahead for Oklahoma. Stay weather savvy. Then at 5:30, things started firing.
So the storms kicked off, and they went off like a bomb.
Yeah, Gary, you're looking at that man. That just formed in the last 30 seconds. Now, right.
The
now,
storm is massive. If you go online and watch some of the videos, it looks like the entire sky is conspiring behind a curtain of dark clouds and rain. Somewhere in there, an incoherent mass is working itself into a tornado. But it was impossible for chasers to see what was coming.
We're only getting very intermittent backlit. Like when lightning flashes, you can sometimes get a peek inside of a rain-wrapped storm and see if there's a tornado inside.
Turned out there wasn't just one. There were a bunch of them.
It's a multiple vortex. I've got a vortice here, a vortice there, south-southeast of the gas plant. No more. It is turning like a top. Absolutely amazing, Gary, amazing.
Soon the vortices within the tornado, which were the size of average-sized tornadoes, were reaching speeds close to 300 miles per hour, and things were just getting started. Coming out of the gates, El Reno headed south to southeast. Then it starts hooking left, or northeast, a move that caught a lot of chasers off guard.
I ripped myself away for a moment, and I looked at the overall storm, and I was like, hey guys, look over there. Is that the tornado? Does that look like the tornado to you? Because that looks like a tornado to me. And there's a reason that this is the largest tornado on record. So right about that point was when the tornado expanded in size. It doubled in size, and it increased its forward motion, I think, to something like 50 or 60 miles per hour, almost instantaneously.
Her and her team were directly in the tornado's path.
We moved quickly. We hauled east. And sure enough, that actually was the tornado.
15 minutes after first touching down, the tornado, still moving east, passes over a major highway, Route 81. At that exact time, chasing legend Tim Samaras passes 81 driving parallel and just north of the storm. The tornado was now speeding straight towards Oklahoma City, a city with a metro area of close to 1.5 million people. In Instead of taking shelter, though, some residents got in their car and headed south trying to beat the storm. This turned out to be a terrible, terrible idea.
Let's talk here with Jim Gardner and Scotty's Nine. Jim, go ahead.
Well, Gary, right now we're passing over I-35. We're just southwest of the storm, south of downtown Oklahoma City.
Heading south, the highway is a standstill of glowing headlights.
And there's I-35, Gary. That is a parking lot. If this thing passes over I-35, it's just going to be disastrous again. These people need to get off the highway.
Just before El Reno died out and almost barreled through a traffic jam, the tornado hooked even harder left just west of the city.
I'm honestly looking back at it, there are some people that should be thanking the Lord Jesus that they're not dead, because there's a lot of people that got in some serious trouble.
The El Reno tornado was on the ground for 45 minutes, traveling over 16 miles. Brick homes were decimated. Steel barns evaporated into thin air. And considering this was the largest tornado ever on record, there were fewer casualties than might have been expected. But while some in Oklahoma were counting their blessings, the chasing community was mourning.
Well, we have some breaking news to share with you here at the Weather Channel. We can now report that 3 of the 9 people who died in Friday's tornadoes in El Reno, Oklahoma, were storm chasers.
Really, as the storm hooked left, it avoided that crowded freeway, but 55-year-old Tim Samaras, his son Paul, and their chase partner and meteorologist Carl Young were right in its path. An amateur chaser also died along with 18 others. While chasers have been in fatal car accidents in the past, this was the first time any chaser had died at the hands of a storm.
Well, weather is a very tight community, and joining me right now is severe weather expert Dr. Greg Forbes, who knew Tim in particular very well. And Dr. Forbes, I know it's supposed to be tough to talk about today, but Tim was the cream of the crop when it came to researchers.
Yeah, I'm terribly saddened. My condolences to his family. I knew Tim very well, and he was a pioneer in terms of taking scientific measurements.
Now, you know, I think people forget that the nature of that type of research, that mode of research, it requires that you have an aggressive chasing style. It requires you to lower the bar for safety in the name of science.
When you were in a room with Tim Samaras, he made you feel like the most important person in the room.
No question about it.
And no matter who you were, I mean, I'm just some ninth grade little hillbilly with an attitude half the time. And when I went to my first storm chaser convention, I was shunned by a lot of these guys. And Tim treated me just as an equal. We compared pros. We talked. I mean, he's 90% the reason why I started doing what I do.
We saw that storm. We ran from that storm, you know, and it makes you question for a moment, why are we out there? What are we doing? What are the motivators here?
We know that when you're chasing storms, eliminating risk is impossible. And it's just a matter of time before something terrible either happens to you or someone you know. Randy, who has seen friends shot, stabbed, overdosed, says it's what he's seen chasing that haunts him.
I still find myself, I'll turn into a ball of and cry for 2 or 3 hours. Just out of the blue over a victim I saw 7 years ago.
Other chasers told me about seeing therapists or being prescribed antidepressants. I was told how hard they crash after chasing season, how they negotiate the lifestyle with their families if they don't end in divorce. When I would talk with chasers, 30-minute interviews regularly turned into hour, 2-hour-long talks, sometimes much longer than that. My only takeaway here was that there was a lot of processing still happening. I started to wonder, are chasers victims here? Trapped by an economic setup that'll never pay them enough for the costs incurred?
They are benefiting financially from you going out into a storm and getting that kind of footage. Is there any responsibility to take care of the people that they ask to do those things?
I can only speak for me personally, and for me, there's really not, because the attitude I take towards it, I would be out there doing this whether I made money off of it or not.
And this is what every chaser told me. I would be out here doing this regardless. I wanted to know then, what's really driving them? I reached out to someone who knows the community intimately.
My name is Jason Persoff. I'm known colloquially in the community as the storm doctor.
Persoff's a physician at the University of Colorado. He's also been storm chasing for 25 years. He provides a free counseling service for chasers in distress.
There's actually a very strong correlation between chasers and addiction.
What Persoff sees as the getting down to it real talk motivation for some chasers It's not money, science, or even public service. It's a feedback loop of addictive behavior.
I think a lot of chasers rely a lot on the feedback from not only the community, but the public in a general sense about their value as a chaser is tied to the quality or the intensity of the footage that they get.
And this feedback loop plays right to a chaser's ego. Persoff says some people have even had to bow out completely from chasing because of the damage it's done to their self-esteem. For others, it can push them to take bigger and bigger risks.
My name's Kelly Williamson.
Come on, get it up there.
Randy Arnold and I track storms for the Weather Channel.
People described Kelly Williamson to me as a thrill seeker. He was a farmer who also raced cars. When he came to storm chasing later in life, he blew the doors off the community with his early videos, even parlaying it into his own show on the Weather Channel in 2016.
Storm Wranglers, this Sunday at 9 on the Weather Channel.
He was a great person, had a great personality. I treasured his friendship, but he was a very stubborn individual. He thought he knew everything.
Randy Hicks became a sort of mentor for Williamson. They even started chasing together. The last time they chased, they got into it. They were of two different minds of where exactly to chase and ended up missing a tornado. Randy took the quiet ride home to confront Williamson on his aggressive style.
I told him, I said, look, dude, you know, this is crazy. You're going to kill somebody. You're going to kill yourself. What good is all this? What's it worth? I said, you know, you've got this live stream going all the time. What's the Weather Channel going to think if you come around the corner and there's some Amish boy out here playing a basketball and you hit him at 80 miles an hour?
Kelly Williamson live streamed all of his chases.
Kelly, you're on the Weather Channel with your stream.
His last ever stream happened at 3:30 p.m. on March 28th, 2017.
Somebody with a stream just to the north, Brett Henderson. Man, it is just rain-wrapped son of a gun.
The crash happened near Spur, Texas, about 70 miles east of Lubbock. Weather Channel contractors Kelly Williamson and Randall Yarnell reportedly ran a stop sign in their SUV before crashing into a Jeep driven by another storm chaser, Corbin Lee Jaeger, on Tuesday afternoon.
Williamson was ejected from the vehicle. Both he and Yarnell died in the crash. So did the 25-year-old chaser they crashed into, Corbin Lee Jaeger.
A lot of people delude themselves into thinking that they're providing a vital public service being a chaser. And in fact, actually, we are as a group a hazard.
The chasers I talked to were dedicated to the science of the storms. I heard it over and over again about why they chase and why it's worth the cost. I wrote to the National Weather Service in Oklahoma asking about it. They wrote back and told me that chasers can be useful during severe weather, but overall, they're not helpful.
The reason we do this is for one reason and really one reason only. We really like seeing severe weather.
But it's not just chasers that love storms and severe weather. It's most of us, myself included. And major networks know it too. Check out some of the Weather Channel's original programming. Why Planes Crash, So You Think You'd Survive, and Weather Gone Viral, First-Hand Accounts of Surviving Treacherous Conditions. This is just a sampling. The truth is, we tune into the spectacle of other people's tragedies with some mix of horror and excitement. People even pay thousands of dollars to go on storm chasing tours, heading out with an experienced chaser to check storms out up close. The storm doctor says if the community doesn't start getting more self-critical and open to change, we can expect to see more Kelly Williamsons out there.
Many of us in the chasing community have been amazed that so few chasers have been killed. And more to the point, that chasers haven't killed more people.
And do you think that's something that's bound to change?
We're way overdue. So Kelly Williamson's death with his partner and taking the innocent life of Corbin, that's shot across the bow. We're going to see more chaser death.
And as an audience, we have some role here too. But regardless of how many people keep tuning into live streams or YouTube, the extreme weather will keep coming.
I think we're going to have an explosive, maybe even a record amount of tornadoes this year.
All you can hope is that the people that are rushing into the eye of a storm can see what they're doing.
But we're going to do some great things this year. This is going to be our year. This may be my last year, but it's going to be a great year. And if God's willing, hopefully I'll get at least into three of those and be able to put my probe out. If I can do two or three of them, I'd be a happy man.
Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Our next story starts on May 19th, 2016, with a man named Robert Kay standing at the top of Mount Everest.
You know, stepping foot onto the summit was just an incredible few moments. You know, there's this sense of elation and happiness for having got there.
The skies were clear, sunny, not much wind. It was the moment Kay had been hoping for.
Oh, yes. This is something that I have been dreaming of since I was about 15 years old.
He says he barely even felt cold.
I suppose it was cold, but I didn't feel cold. My gear was working very well, and I didn't feel cold, although there was quite a bit of frostbite that night.
Kay summited along with 2 days' worth of climbers because bad weather the day before had caused a backup. At points, the hiker traffic was so thick that Kay and his team would be stalled for 10 or 15 minutes at a time. But he made it, fulfilled his dream, and started down the mountain. The going was slow, too slow. Coming down from the summit to the south summit is about a 15-20 minute trip normally.
It took us 2 hours, again because of crowding.
Soon, things started to feel wrong.
I could hardly go more than a few steps without having to sit down and rest. I would breathe as hard as I could, and I'd get no relief.
Even when he sat down, he couldn't recover.
Imagine putting a plastic bag over your face and just tightening it up. That's how it feels. You know, I compared it for one person. I said it's like breathing through a garden hose. You got 50 feet of garden hose, and you're underwater. You're trying to suck air through this thing, and you just can't get enough air.
Kay was developing a severe case of high-altitude pulmonary edema, or HAPE. It's the lungs' response to getting too little air for too long. They started to fill up with fluid. Eventually, it'll drown you.
That's basically what I was doing. I was drowning or suffocating because my lungs were filling up with fluid.
Kay spent a sleepless night at Camp 4, which is at about 26,000 feet. His friends kept him awake so he wouldn't go into shock and gave him some medications to get him through the night. The next day, the team descended from Camp 4 to Camp 2, which is a long, nearly vertical down climb. Kay's Sherpas and teammates unclipped and clipped Kay from every anchor point on the mountain and took his pack. At one point, they had to switch out his oxygen tank for a new one.
And taking away that last little bit of oxygen sent me over the edge, and I started convulsing or spasming on the ground, and I couldn't even sit up. And I thought to myself, I'm going to die in the next few seconds. And if you asked me that today, I'd think I'd get all scared. At that point, it just became an interesting fact. It was like, I get to know where and when I die. That's interesting. If the pain's going to stop, that's good. And I didn't even care that I was about to die.
But Kay doesn't die.
Because someone was there to intervene.
Global Rescue, a life-saving business. This company has been rescuing people from dangerous situations since 2004. And Cordelia Zars is here to walk us through how the company works, who it works for, and what it means to be rescued.
Okay, so what you need to know about Robert Kay, the guy stranded on Everest, is that before he left, he bought a membership with Global Rescue. It's a business that offers full evacuation services to people who find themselves in sticky situations around the world.
So we provide medical evacuation, security evacuation and extraction, information and intelligence, and virtual healthcare services to really three categories of clients.
That's Dan Richards, the CEO and founder of Global Rescue. Did you catch everything you just said?
No. One more time.
Okay, so let me break it down. New Hampshire-based company, right? But with offices around the world. They have offices in Lebanon, Boston, Salt Lake City, Amsterdam, the Netherlands, Ukraine, places in Southeast Asia.
Man, all over the place.
Yeah. And what Dan Richards just explained is that they provide three different kinds of services. So medical services, security services, and virtual healthcare. So Sam, let's say you're headed out on a big trip to...
Canada.
Serious?
Let's say Madagascar.
Madagascar. Wonderful. But you've never been there before, and you're a little nervous about all the vicious lemurs, right? And you want some backup. So you buy a medical membership with Global Rescue, which is
structured a little bit like AAA, but not for your car, for your body.
Which means if something goes wrong, you can call them. They will direct you to local hospitals and provide all the consultation you need to get properly treated. They're partnered with doctors at Johns Hopkins, so they know what they're doing. And if something goes seriously wrong,
we'll rescue you out of the field. We'll bring you to a place where you can get stabilized and treated. And then we'll bring you all the way home if you're, in fact, in bad shape. If not, you're treated and released. That's part of your membership. You won't be charged. And it's a very nice and affordable way for people to protect themselves from some of the big expenses that would result from a rescue.
$329 a year for that membership, okay?
Does that cover the cost of treatment or just the rescue?
Oh, yeah, no, so just the rescue and the consultation. It's not medical insurance, but when you think about what you'd have to pay out of pocket for a private helicopter rescue, $329 doesn't seem too steep.
I actually have no idea what to even think about how much a private helicopter rescue would cost.
So off of Everest, we're looking at like $15,000 to $20,000 to get
Whoa.
You.
Whoa.
Yeah, so a lot. Okay, so on top of that medical membership, if you want, you can add security in case you're traveling somewhere that erupts into war or civil unrest.
So for instance, the Arab Spring is a good example. We had lots of folks who were trapped in Alexandria and Cairo and in parts of Tunisia during the uprisings in those locations.
So Global Rescue deployed security teams to bring their members to a safe place. They did the same thing for members in Mumbai after the 2008 terrorist attacks. And they don't just cater to individual members. They have tons of corporate and government clients too, including NASA, the US government, and National Geographic. And then, you know, your host of normal people who are just out for an adventure. Just last year, Global Rescue had about 1 million clients.
So who is rescuing all those people?
Many of their employees come from a military background, and they go through some pretty intense training to make sure they're up for the task. And besides the crazy manpower they have to get things done, they also have the resources. Listen to this.
We've got literally thousands of aircraft around the world under contract. So rotary wing, which are helicopters, fixed wing, airplanes. And we do a lot of these, many thousands of them, every single year.
What? So does that mean that they can just call these people up at any moment and have them fly out to wherever they need?
Yeah, essentially. Yep. So if something happens, they call these people that they have under contract, and those people will provide.
It's wild.
Yeah. And besides aircraft, they use all sorts of ground transportation, like ambulances, vans, you name it. And sometimes if the weather's really bad, or like in Nepal, there just aren't roads in some places, so motorized vehicles can't reach the patient.
And so we'll put them on a yak or a horse, you know, sometimes accompanied by one of our personnel, as soon as possible.
Yaks under contract.
They always come through.
Yeah, yaks are very dependable.
Rain or shine. Yeah, so they've got you covered. They'll come get you anywhere in the world besides North Korea. And to make something clear, not all these people are getting rescued all the time. Most people go on their trips, it's all smooth, and they never need the backup.
Most of what we do in our operations centers every day is fairly mundane. It honestly is. So maybe not the answer you wanted to hear, but that's actually, we spend our days dealing with people who come down with traveler's diarrhea or slip and fall in their hotel rooms or are calling in to, they've just bought a membership, they want to know what vaccines should I get.
But occasionally, yes, something does go very wrong, which brings us back to our friend Robert Kay, who's near the top of Mount Everest.
And I thought to myself, I'm going to die in the next few seconds. And if you asked me that today, I'd think I'd get all scared. At that point, it just became an interesting fact. It was like, huh, I get to know where and when I die. That's interesting. If the pain's going to stop, that's good. And I didn't even care that I was about to die.
Nemo, Nemo, warning. Copy. Hope you have a good weather up there.
At 21,000 feet, Global Rescue sent a helicopter to pick up Robert K.
I have Robert.
At the Pilsk, Robert.
Okay.
Kay says it was like seeing the cavalry coming.
You don't know for sure if you're going to live or die for 48 hours, and all of a sudden, you know, guaranteed, you're going to make it.
Okay, I have Robert, and we're going to Lukla Hospital.
You know, it's like, we're going to die, we're going to die. Nope, we're going to make it.
They flew Kay into a small clinic in Lukla, a town at the base of Everest. And from there, he was transferred to a bigger hospital in Kathmandu, where he rested and recovered before he caught his flight back to the United States. And the remarkable thing is that Global Rescue's work with Kate didn't stop there.
Their staff was amazing. You know, I expect them just to say, yeah, we'll pay the bill, good luck. But, you know, they're in fact, even in my case, they would come and visit the hospital every day just to check on us, see how we were doing, They were an amazing group of people. It wasn't just simply pay the claim and move on. It was, how are you doing as a person?
And that's what I've heard from every client I've talked to, that Global Rescue really cares.
That's pretty bonkers.
The tricky thing, though, Sam, is that hundreds of people climb Everest every year. And some of those people are signed up to get saved if something happens, and some of them aren't, because they can't pay for a service like Global Rescue's.
Right, like the Sherpas.
Like the Sherpas. In fact, out of about 280 people that have died on Everest, an estimated 114 of them have been Sherpas. So who is Global Rescue making the mountain safer for?
It's making extreme adventure easier and safer for the privileged. And it's not making it easier and safer for everybody else.
That's Ben Ayers, the country director for the Z Foundation in Nepal. He's been helping improve working conditions for mountain porters and their communities for the past 18 years. And Ben says companies like Global Rescue might be contributing to a culture of mountaineers taking greater risks than they would if they had to rescue themselves. Risks that could endanger lives besides their own. And is that fair?
And we've arrived at our second story.
And it starts with Courtney Christman.
I'm ready.
Who, back in 2010, was in her senior year of college in Pennsylvania. She'd been going to the same church since she was little, the Christmertz Lutheran Church in Fleetwood. And she'd been on a few mission trips when she was younger, which she liked so much that she decided to lead her own week-long mission trip her senior year to Haiti.
The mission of this specific trip was to go down, and we were going to spend some of the time working with the children at the school that was there. And then we were going to spend time kind of out and about doing some work on the buildings as well.
Her group, which was 12 people from the church, they flew down to Quatabuque, which is in the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. And there they volunteered for an organization called Village of Hope, which is a nonprofit that provides educational opportunities and basic healthcare to a rural community outside the city.
So that was the original mission of the trip.
Courtney's group helped paint the church and spent time with the children in the Village of Hope school.
You couldn't walk somewhere without somebody giving you a hug.
And although hugs might not be a measure of real impact, Courtney says she felt good about being there.
And then you realize, you know, I'm on this trip because this is where God wants me to be, and I'm on this trip because I needed to learn something from this trip. You know, it puts so much perspective on.
And then.
As we mentioned, the story is still developing. Seth,
the earthquake rocked this impoverished Caribbean nation late this afternoon.
Emergency relief as aid organizations make their way to the scene.
The reports and images that we've seen, collapsed hospitals, crumbled homes, and men and women carrying their injured neighbors through the streets, are truly heart-wrenching.
At 4:53 p.m. on January 12, 2010, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake struck just south of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Courtney and her group were back at their living accommodations after a day of work,
And the ground just kind of started to shake. And I remember just kind of looking at my friend who was sitting beside me, Megan, my friend, and I'm just kind of looking at her with, like, you know, what is happening on my face? And then I heard her yell out to me, and it was like in slow motion. She's like, "It's an earthquake." And then I look and I just see the ground just moving, and it looks like waves. It looked like ocean waves. I mean, it rose 2 feet. It looked like it rose 2 or 3 feet in the air and then dropped.
They were staying in a complex of one-story buildings that had bunks and a kitchen. Fortunately, most of them were sitting outside.
Then I just remember that my dad and my fiance, who's my husband now, Josh, they were both back under the shed. And when I looked back to see if I could see anybody else, the shed, I could see that the shed roof had fallen. Sorry. I could see that the shed roof had fallen, and then it, like, struck me, you know, that fear of, you know, there were some people back there. And so I went running back, and I just remember, you know, hollering all the people's names that were back there. And I didn't hear from anybody, and I couldn't see anybody. And then my fiance had come, and he's like, I'm right here. I'm okay. You know, I'm standing right here. I'm in front of you. And then I see my dad come around, and then I see the other two people come around who were back with them. And, you know, we all just kind of started to congregate in the middle. And there was a lot. There was relief after that when we counted, and everybody was there, and everybody was safe.
Nobody in Courtney's group was hurt, but many other people were. An estimated 3 million people were affected by the earthquake. The death count is highly disputed, but ranges somewhere from 200 to 300,000. 1 million people were left homeless in the aftermath. And today, 2.5 million Haitians are still in need of humanitarian aid.
So what did they do?
Well, at first, the group tried to help. But after a few days, they started to get worried about their supply of food and water and their safety. So at that point, they went to the embassy trying to leave. And they were told that 200 people or more stood ahead of them in line to get out of the country, and that it would probably be weeks before they could get out. So Courtney called her insurance company. She had cell phone service, and she called her insurance company, which called Global Rescue. The earthquake was on Tuesday. On Saturday, two Global Rescue employees arrived in Haiti and whisked the group to the airport at 5 a.m. the next morning. And in front of several hundred people waiting in embassy lines and several thousand more who would never be able to afford to leave their ruined country, Courtney's group boarded one of the first chartered flights out of Haiti.
Wow.
I asked Courtney how it felt.
I just remember sitting on the airplane as we were flying out of Haiti and just, you know, feeling like I wanted to tell the pilot, no, turn around, let me out. You know, I'm not done yet. Let me out. I need to go back. And, you know, you feel very guilty because our plan was to go there and to be there for a week and to, you know, make an impact. And then this happened. And part of it felt like we didn't do enough then. You know, there was still so much work now to be done, and we got to go home.
So it's just a crazy conflict of emotions. You know, on the one hand, she went to Haiti with a specific purpose in mind, to help and to give back, right? But then on the other hand, there's the instinct to survive and to protect the people she's close to above anyone else, which is an instinct that's built right into every cell of our bodies. And is that instinct somehow immoral? I mean, what do you think, Sam?
Wow. Is the instinct immoral? I mean, it's like instincts don't really have morality, right? I don't think the will to survive can be immoral. It's like, what do you do with that? I mean, if I were in that situation, I don't know what I would do. Mm. And I think this feels particularly bad because she was on this religious mission. But when it came down to it, she just saved herself. And to save herself, she called on this system that winds up putting a plane of white folks first in line when there are kids out there waiting for food and water. And I imagine the airport must have just been like chaos.
Yeah, it was. It was a total mess. The runway was so clogged with planes that they couldn't clear them all out for takeoff and landing. And there were planes circling around for hours. also the U.S. military had to come in. So, yeah, it was chaos. But, I mean, that said, we can't trace Courtney's rescue flight to someone else in Haiti that didn't get food or water. It's not that easy. But it does still raise some issues.
My name is Neelan Parker. I'm the former deputy director of the Office of Transition Initiatives at the U.S. Agency for International Development.
Neelan says in a crisis like Haiti, you'll see a lot of different organizations, governments, NGOs, even the United Nations, all vying for the same resources. And who comes out on top draws in stark relief a reality we prefer to ignore.
My experience in aid in general is that there is just a fundamental inequality and injustice, and that in the moments when you are getting on a plane and somebody else isn't getting on a plane are those moments where there's the least amount that you can do to fix that inequality, and it is the most morally troubling.
It just seems like in a disaster like this, Global Rescue, which has so many resources, should have some obligation to confront that inequality and help all those people who can't pay. But do they?
I mean, do they help other people?
Yeah, kind of. Like, if there's room on a flight, they will bring medical supplies and they will evacuate non-members.
Right, so they'll help if it doesn't get in the way of their own clients' survival.
Right, but look, Global Rescue isn't the Red Cross. It's a business, and they have clients who are willing to pay for the services they offer. And can you really condemn Global Rescue or its members for that? Dan Richards, the CEO of Global Rescue, thinks that the choice not to insure your life raises its own moral questions.
You could argue that not doing those things, going to a place like Haiti, could be one of the most selfish things that a person could do, because the people who love you and care about you and who depend on you, if you go and don't come back, you've left them in the lurch. And that's an incredibly selfish thing to do. And we see that from time to time.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm sure there are people out there doing adventures who like don't buy this insurance and they don't think of themselves as selfish or irresponsible.
Right. Okay, well, here's Mark Jenkins. He's the writer in residence for the University of Wyoming, as well as a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. And he's been on all sorts of dangerous adventures. He's an acclaimed mountaineer, and often he goes without any sort of backup plan.
The difficulty obviously rises when affluence gives one person a better chance of survival than another person, a person of lesser means. Which as we discussed, Cord, we already know is precisely how the world works. If you get cancer in Holland, your chances of survival are much higher than if you get cancer in the Congo. We are living not in the world of our choosing, but in the world we have, which is packed full of the haves and the have-nots.
Oh, man. It's like what, I mean, this is like a proxy for what does the developed world owe the developing world.
Right.
And it's like, if we're outraged about this, then we have to be outraged about the entire system of global capitalism.
Right. What would it take? What would it take to reject that whole system and choose to live your life in a way that didn't adhere to any of those values?
Well, and even if you choose to reject that whole system, it's not like it's going away.
Yeah. And I mean, can we expect, is it fair to expect Global Rescue to reject capitalism, throw the free market system out the window, and say, here, we're here to save everybody, you know.
Yeah. And so their position is, we're working on this one thing.
Yeah.
And you can't blame the inequities of the world on us.
Right. Well, here's Mark Jenkins again.
We're always faced with this. I think this is the human condition. And what do we really owe our fellow man?
What do we owe our fellow man?
Yeah, probably more than we're giving them now.
Probably. But when it comes to saving your own life and the lives of the people you love, that question gets a whole lot harder to answer.
Yeah, you're talking to the wrong guy if you want an in-depth, microscopic examination of the moral implications, because I will never be able to understand why there might be a moral question about rescuing somebody. I just, particularly at the risk of your own life, I just, that's just not a moral question in my mind.
I thought we were just going to be talking about Mount Everest. I didn't realize that we were going to be like deconstructing global capitalism in here. Cordelia Czars hijacks the show, and next thing we know...